It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Automobiles play a major role in the U.S. economy and in our lives. We start this hour by talking with a researcher about what cars show us about the political and social differences between us. Drivers, how do you use your car? Do you drive alone to work? Do you carpool? How much do you depend on your car? Maybe you use public transportation. Was there a time when you didn't have a car? How did that affect your life? What do you think about cars? Are they causing problems for our communities, or are they important tools, essential tools, helping us get from point A to B? If you don't have a car, maybe that's by choice. Is your life better for it? How do you commute to work or get to where you need to go? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Richard Florida, co-founder and editor-at-large of City Lab and a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's also a professor at the University of Toronto's School of Cities. His recent City Lab piece is titled How Cars Divide America. Richard Florida, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. It's great to be with you.
Well, let's get a quick history lesson. What was the automobile's role in America's history? What has it been?
Well, I think it's shaped our recent history. It certainly shaped my life. You know, you think about the 20th century, and in fact, we had a name for it. European thinkers and scholars called our 20th century economy Fordism. Think about that, Fordism, named after Henry Ford on two dimensions. One was, of course, the assembly line that Henry Ford invented, which powered, you know, the growth of great cities like Detroit and Cleveland and Milwaukee, great industrial centers. And the other was, of course, the ability of the car to shape a society. So it wasn't just the Fordist assembly line. Fordism, that these scholars, the term the scholars use, really referred to our suburban society, a Fordist society structured around suburban homes where people would commute longer and longer distances to work. So really, the car is kind of the centerpiece of the modern post-war suburban mass production industrial society.
Well, it's kind of ironic in a way that the rise of the automobile built Detroit and also helped empty it later.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one thing I just want to go back to your first point. We were really became the world's most powerful economy on the backs of the car. When you think about it, it was our ability to produce those cars on an assembly line. Henry Ford himself said we have to pay the workers a $5 day, then it was a lot of money, so that they could afford to buy a car. And then we coupled that with a system of low-cost mortgages, which enabled this working class, this blue-collar working class, like my dad, working in a factory in Newark, New Jersey, to buy a suburban home, to buy a car, and to keep the demand for those assembly lines rising. So it really built our society, but unfortunately, of course, now we've hit a turning point where instead of being a driver of economic growth, the car is in a way a hinderer of economic growth.
How so?
Well, I think that, you know, and I talk about this a little bit in the piece, the car was really the driver of the old industrial economy, that blue-collar factory job. But now, you know, we don't make a lot of things in the United States. In fact, here's a telling statistic for listeners. In the United States in 1950, about half of our workforce were blue-collar manufacturing workers. Today, about 5 or 6% of our workforce toil in production occupations in factories. So we have become a knowledge and service economy. And in fact, many of the manufactured goods we buy are no longer made in America. You know, they're made overseas. So the car and the industrial economy no longer powers growth. And it has come, you know, in a way to clog our cities and to spread us out so much that it in some ways runs counter the things we need to do to build a more thriving, robust, prosperous knowledge economy.
Well, and the concept of gridlock isn't just a political one. In fact, the term comes from the way our freeways look. I don't live in a big city. We don't have a rush hour where I live. We have sort of a rush minute. But I've been in some major metropolitan areas. I'll never forget the hour and a half it took to get from the L.A. airport to Anaheim. And it was a 15-minute trip on a Saturday afternoon, but the freeways are giant parking lots. Same thing is true in most metro areas. And so it gives us this mobility, but at the same time, you point out there's all this congestion, and it's kind of the opposite of what we wanted from automobiles.
Well, absolutely. You know, when my mom and dad bought their suburban house in working class New Jersey, probably took my dad and his 1967 Chevy Impala 15 minutes to drive from North Arlington, New Jersey to Newark, New Jersey. Who knows? It might take an hour today. I was recently flew into San Francisco and had to go do something in Sacramento. It took 4 hours. It could take me 2 hours today. To go from downtown Toronto, where I live, to the Toronto airport, depending on traffic. But here's one for you. The last time I was in Milwaukee giving a talk at Marquette, fantastic audience, I was asking my driver, cab driver, you know, how long would it take if I needed to go to Chicago? I didn't need to go to Chicago, but I said, how long would it take to go to Chicago? He said, well, I forget what he said, something, but rounding numbers. He said, well, it'd probably take us an hour and a half to get in the suburban periphery of Chicago. And then it might take us another hour and a half to get into Chicago, those last 10 or so miles. So I think that tells you everything you need to know, that yes, the car can move us around, but when there's too many cars, it really holds us back. And, you know, if you think about a knowledge economy that turns on the velocity of moving people and ideas, the faster we can move people, the faster we can move ideas, the faster ideas and knowledge can combine and recombine, the more we grow. Well, if we're just stuck in gridlock, there goes our knowledge economy.
Well, and in a knowledge economy, isn't the end game that we don't move people, we simply move the knowledge?
Well, I think that, you know, that's a great point. And I think one of the things we're finding, you know, the research is finding that in order to move ideas, you have to move people. That this whole fallacy that the internet or the social media or technology would somehow substitute from face-to-face interaction is a falsity. And that, in fact, what we found, you know, is that instead of people spreading themselves all out, all over the plane, all out for the planet, we are packing ourselves into denser and denser areas and neighborhoods. This is what part of the Back to the City movement has been about. And in fact, there is an extraordinary statistical association between dense urban places and levels of innovation and levels of startup. So who would have thunk it? You know, when I was a boy, they said innovation comes from suburban areas and office parks and what one guy called a nerdistan, where the engineers go in this green campus. What we're finding today, though, is the most innovative places on the planet are areas around downtown San Francisco, the old bohemian quarters of New York City, pieces of London and Berlin that are in the urban center. So in a way, this density of people and density of ideas, this concentration of human beings and knowledge go together to power innovation and economic growth.
Interesting. We already have some callers who want to join the discussion. Let's welcome Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Well, I wish I didn't have to have a car simply because they're so expensive. And I do live in town, and so I try to ride my bike to things as much as I can. But I have two jobs, and I have to go from one to the other, so I don't have the time to spend on trying to get public transportation. And that's an issue I wish Wisconsin would deal with, is more public transportation.
Cindy, thanks for your comment. What about Cindy's story? She wishes she didn't have to have a car because they're very expensive. But in order to be able to work, she needs the car.
So I tell my wife this all the time. We have two little kids, and we bought an SUV to have two car seats. But I tell her this all the time. This is going to be our last car. And I think Cindy hits on it. In fact, in big cities, maybe not where we're in Appleton, but in big cities for sure, the most effective way to get around is bicycle. And I find myself bicycling to and from work in Toronto, but it's terribly dangerous. I just had a little fall. I didn't get hurt very badly. But we don't have enough protected bike lanes. In New York City now, when I go to New York for meetings, because they have such a nice bike lane infrastructure with protected lanes, I bike everywhere, even more than I use transit. But Cindy's point is that I think in our future, yes, we'll use a car, or we'll take a cab, or we'll take a ride-hailing service like Uber. but we'll live closer to work, we'll walk more, we'll use a bike, or we'll take transit. And one thing that I think is very important when we think about the great Midwest of this country, you know, this economic geographer named John Gottman, way back when, said there were two great mega regions that define our future. One was the one with the Boston, New York, Washington corridor. If you think about that, it has subways, but it also has this transit, almost high, not high-speed rail, but fast rail line running from Boston through New York through Washington called Amtrak. Well, you know, in our great Midwest, one way I think of making our cities more connected, Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, would be an investment in high-speed rail that, you know, if you're living in Milwaukee and wanted to commute to Chicago, that could be a 45-minute commute. If you're living in Detroit and wanted to commute to Toronto or Chicago, you could do it, maybe not on a daily basis. So I think this idea of transit and high-speed rail is another thing we've got to think about for the future.
800-642-1234. Cindy, thanks for your call. Let's take a call next from Frank, who joins us from Springbrook, way up in northern Wisconsin. Frank, welcome to the morning show.
Yes, hi. I was going to say, I lived in South Korea for 6.5 years. I taught English there at two different universities, and for 6.5 years, I never got behind the wheel of a car. I just used public transportation. And I loved it. You know, now I live in northern Wisconsin, and I am forced to drive. And auto repairs and gas and all that, it's so much more expensive. And I'd rather go back to the old system in a heartbeat. And you know, even in South Korea, rural areas have mass they have mass transportation. You can catch a bus out in the middle of nowhere in South Korea. Mm-hmm. But we have nothing like that up here in northern Wisconsin.
Richard, Florida, to give you an idea of where Springbrook is, it's in a very rural area of far northern Wisconsin. I know this because I grew up in Hayward, which is just what we would say has a hop, skip, and a jump from Springbrook. But it's one of those cities that originally, when the railroads ran everywhere, it was a railroad stop. And there were dozens, hundreds of those in rural parts of America, and they're all, the villages are there. But the transportation system is not. Is this a uniquely U.S. thing? He mentions he was in South Korea. We know that there's a lot of mass transit in Japan. People always talk about going around Europe on trains and being able to get everywhere they need to go without having to have a car. Is this something that's a uniquely United States concept?
I think to some degree. To some degree, we're a bigger country. We're more spread out. We also pulled out a lot of those rail lines and subway lines and transit lines and street. We ripped them out in places like Detroit. But I think so. And I think it's just not only in, as you said, in Asia, where they've been building transit lines and subway lines and high-speed rail lines like crazy, and in Japan with the fastest high-speed rail in the world. In Europe, you know, even if you take places that are far less big and dense than New York and Chicago, they have functional transit and subway systems. So, yeah, I think we decided that we wanted to build our society around the car, and that benefited us for about 100 years. That seemed like a good decision. It seems like a less good decision now. And I think what both callers emphasized is something that, you know, studies bear out. For many people, having to own a car is the difference between being able to save money and live within their means and living on the edge, the financial edge. You know, there are now good studies of this that show that saving households are the ones that are able to cut down on these car expenses. And as you know, it's not just one car. It's mom and dad, and if you have teenage kids who have to get to school, it's cars for the kids. So those car expenses add up in a way that can be very, very financially burdensome for American households.
800-642-1234, the number to call. Frank, thanks for your call. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more with our guest, Richard Florida, co-founder and editor-at-large of CityLab and senior editor at The Atlantic. Richard, one of the things I want to get to when we come back is how politically, what cars show us about our politically divided nation. I want to make sure we get to that, and we have some more callers. I'm John Munson. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Cars Can Divide Us. That's the premise of a recent CityLab article by Richard Florida, my guest this hour. What do you think the automobile has done to our society? Do cars divide us? Are they unhealthy for our culture? Is there a better way? We're talking about those issues with Richard Florida, co-founder and editor-at-large of CityLab and a senior editor at The Atlantic. We have a number of callers who want to join us, Richard Florida, and let's take one of them. Mike in Jefferson has a point that I think needs to be made here. Mike, go ahead.
Yes, I heard your guest mentioning faster to get to knowledge and ideas. He talks that that's basically the unmitigated worship of Silicon Valley. We have the FDA for a reason. It makes sure that we have some kind of fence or bulwark against anything that's released to the public. And so these rideshare things that happen, or this new controversy with this scooter that's invading cities across the country, there is no type of testing before stuff is released to the market. Now, to the point of bigger cities attracting people, recent studies have shown that people are moving away from the bigger cities because of the idea of the creative class. Being in these big cities, if you are not part of the creative class, you're priced out of the market. You can't afford the rent, and you have to take menial jobs in the periphery. And so that's why places like Madison are starting to thrive, because people are realizing they can't afford living in San Francisco.
Richard Florida?
Well, thank you. I think that's my work. I think that's my work. I'm the author of that work. And I think you're absolutely right that what's happened in these superstar cities, and I've written a whole new book about it called The New Urban Crisis, is they become so pricey and unaffordable that richer and richer people can live there. And many tech companies do gravitate to downtown San Francisco, but other folks are looking to smaller places. And you're absolutely right. That's not every smaller place, but that is particularly college towns like Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Gainesville, Florida, Lexington, Kentucky, Boulder, Colorado, all top the list on a per capita basis of startup technology companies. But one thing that the caller also gets to is that cars are a critical dimension of our economic and political divide. And that's what I got to in this place in the CityLab in The Atlantic. If you take metropolitan areas, richer metropolitan areas where incomes are higher and wages are higher, fewer people drive alone to work, more people take transit, walk, or bike. If you take denser places versus more sprawling places, in the denser places, of course, fewer people drive alone to work, more people take transit or walk or bike to work. But what's really telling, if you look at votes for Republicans versus Democrats, Trump versus Clinton, Obama versus Romney, you find the same darn pattern. Places where people depend more on the car skew more conservative. Places where people walk, bike, and use transit more skew more liberal. So I think the point is, we've talked about this rural-urban divide in our country, small versus large. I think those who are forced to depend on the car take on a different political outlook than those who walk or bike or take transit. And it is one of the, not the only, but a key dimension of this great polarization in America is who is forced to depend on a car and who has the luxury or the ability to walk, bike, or use transit to get to work.
Well, you know, this is one of the disappointing things about talk shows. We need to let you go because you have another meeting to go to, but we could easily do another hour on this topic, and we have a lot of callers who would like to get on. I'd like to just close with something, though. Knowing what you do about how cars are affecting us, the research that you've done, the studies you've made, what's ahead for us and for cars here in the United States?
I think our political divide will continue to turn on this. And, you know, I quote these great researchers at Stanford and other universities. Really, I think we underestimate the power of the car in structuring the way we live and the places we live and the way not only we live and work, but the way we vote. And I think when we come to really to reckon with America's political divide, it's going to have a lot to do with those of us who use cars and those who don't. Here's what I think, by the way. I don't think we should impose one way or the other way, my way or the highway, I think we have to give people, those people who want to drive a car and live in a small place and use a car, the opportunity to do that. But those of us who want to take transit and walk and live and bike to work, the opportunity to do that. I think we have to find a way to mutually coexist in a divided nation. So I think that's our only way forward. Get away from this national politics and get focused on what we can do locally to make our places better.
Okay, well, and that's where we're going to have to leave it. Richard Florida, thank you so much for the brief time you were able to spend with us this morning.
Delight being with you. Thank you for talking about this critical issue.
Note to producers, let's have Richard come back for a longer time next time. Richard Florida is co-founder and editor-at-large of CityLab and a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's also professor at the University of Toronto's School of Cities and an avid bike rider. His recent CityLab piece is called How Cars Divide America. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. I'm going to switch topics now a little bit, still on the transportation theme, but kind of something to one of our callers earlier this hour alluded to. The Milwaukee Common Council voted on Tuesday to allow the city to impound motorized bird scooters left out on the street, stopping short of a total ban. We're going to discuss that this hour. Do you live in Milwaukee? Have you used one of Bird's electric scooters? What was that experience like? And do you think these scooters and other similar sharing programs are a good thing for the city, or are they a problem? Well, we'll talk about that with a reporter from the Milwaukee Business Journal who's covering this. Nick Williams is a reporter who covers residential real estate, transportation, and technology for the Milwaukee Business Journal, and he joins us this morning. Nick, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So the Milwaukee Common Council passed an ordinance this week involving electric scooter startup Bird Rides Incorporated that says the city could impound these scooters. We're going to get back to that. But first, Nick, when did these scooters show up in Milwaukee?
That would be the first day of Summerfest. I believe that was June 27th. That morning that Summerfest started is when Bird sent out the release. I guess some people of the media got the release. I was one of them, saying that they were available in Milwaukee's Third Ward to begin with, and they just started from there.
So how does this work? Bird Rides Incorporated, how do people use these scooters, and how much do they cost, that kind of thing?
So you download their app to your phone, and it's like the app gives you a map of where the scooters are located, and it costs a dollar. Once you find it, it charges your credit card a dollar to unlock the scooter, as they say it, and then it's 15 cents per minute that you're riding the scooter. It also requires you to upload your driver's license information. I think there's like a short tutorial to take as well.
Do we have any sense of how many scooters are in the city of Milwaukee?
It's a little over 100. I don't know if initially it was 100, but there have been reports of just over 100 in the downtown Milwaukee area.
So let's say I upload the app, or download the app, and I fill out all the information, and they've got my credit card, my driver's license, blah, blah, blah. And so I get on one of these scooters, and I go from point A to point B. Then what do I do with it?
Well, once you're done with it, you just leave it there. That's kind of the allure of this business model. You pick it up wherever you find it, or if you track it, you know, if through the app, and then once you're done with it, you just leave it anywhere, and that's how they operate.
Okay, so these things are left on the sidewalk in front of businesses, and then an app allows us to locate one near us, and we go get it. Okay, I get that. So the concerns that have been raised in Milwaukee, and not just Milwaukee, but other cities where this company has been leaving its scooters, what are they? What are people concerned about?
It seems like in every city where they launch, the problem is they don't get the proper permits or the proper operating business license. They don't go to the city. I think most recently, the most recent city is Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they actually filed for the permit, but they never waited for approval. They just still went ahead and launched their business. So that's the problem in every city, is that they just show up and scatter the scooters around the city and start their business without getting a proper permit or the operating business license. And cities just don't like being bypassed like that.
Well, it doesn't offer them any opportunity to incorporate these vehicles into any kind of a plan or anything like that. Specifically in Wisconsin, isn't there a legal issue with how the state defines a vehicle?
There is, and Milwaukee City Attorney has, since the first week that these bikes, these scooters launched, says that state statute doesn't permit these motorized scooters in public rights of way. Now, Byrd has consistently argued that the city's interpretation of that statute is not exactly clear, because they're saying that it doesn't specifically say motorized scooters in the statute. So I think that's maybe some of the confusion, or maybe the why these companies, the company that's going back and forth, is just, it's one interpretation versus the other, whether or not these are legal. Byrd says they can be used like bicycles in the bike lane. I think how the city's interpreting the state statute is that, no, these are motorized vehicles that should not be allowed on public sidewalks. And if they are being used, they should have to be registered in some type of way.
Okay, so for those who have not seen one of these, can you describe, when we say scooter, the first time I heard this, I was thinking moped, but this is actually this isn't something you sit on, you stand on it, right?
You stand on it. It's like an old school scooter that you stand on, and, you know, kids used to push themselves on it, but now, because it's electric motor with it, there's a little throttle on the handlebars that you hold down. I've seen some people push themselves. I don't know if it's because they don't know how to operate or what, but you simply just hold down the throttle and travel throughout the city that way.
Wow. And what kind of speeds are we talking about here? I mean, if these are out in traffic, how fast can they be driven? Do you know?
I'm thinking top speed, maybe 15 miles an hour. Okay. I've seen some zipping down downtown Milwaukee streets going pretty fast. So I would think that's their top speed, is about maybe 10 to 15 miles an hour.
Okay. Well, if you hit something, even if you're going 15 miles an hour, you're going to go flying. There are some people have raised some safety concerns about these, but they're probably the same safety concerns that are raised about bicycles. Would that be fair to say?
Well, there has been an incident already where somebody riding a Byrd scooter hit a woman on the sidewalk. I think she sustained minor injuries, but I think with the bicycle, similar thing. If someone were to crash into you, where a bicycle is pretty, hurtful. But
sure,
the fact that these are going a little bit faster, and that I think you could brake faster maybe on a bike. I mean, that's just my interpretation of it.
Right. And we didn't bring you in here as an expert on the mechanics of scooters. I just want to mention that we do have a link to your article about this on the morning show program notes for this hour, so people can go to WPR.org and navigate to the program notes for this 8 o'clock hour on August 1st and see a link to the article and find out some of the details about what's going on in Milwaukee. I just want to mention that people can call in and be part of the program this morning at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address works too, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings as well. My guest this hour is Nick Williams, a reporter covering residential real estate, transportation, and technology for the Milwaukee Business Journal. He is following this story about the scooters and has joined us here this morning to talk about what he has learned. And you certainly are welcome to join the conversation. So, do you have any sense about how people who have used this service feel about it? Are they happy with it? Are they in favor of it? Would they like to see the city work more closely with this company to make it possible?
For sure. There's definitely a lot of people who support the dockless scooter here in Milwaukee. From what I've seen, it's mostly the younger population, even though there are some people who are you know, a little bit older who enjoyed them too. But just looking on social media, some of the younger leaders in the business community are very much behind it because they see it as an innovative way to get throughout the city. It's an innovative mode of transportation, and this generation of millennials is all about innovative and trying something new and different. And because it's also very inexpensive, as opposed to hopping on a bus, or if you need to go a couple of blocks, plus it's kind of cool. Now, those who are opposed to it, I think, are a little bit older, maybe who more traditional in what they see around the city. You know, a bicycle's okay. You know, we've got to kind of accustomed to skateboards too, but seeing this thing just zip by, I think the fact that people are just leaving them on the sidewalk is what's bothering most of the people who are against this. Not the fact that they're riding them, it's the fact that they're just blocking, they're just situated on sidewalks throughout the city, or sometimes just laid on a lawn or something like that. I think that's, for those who oppose it, that's their biggest beef with it.
Let's take a call here before we go to our break. Mark in Franklin joins us. Mark, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'll just say right now, I'm in my eighth decade, so I'm one of the older people, but I think they're really cool looking. I'm a bicyclist and a hiker myself. The only thing that bothers me about them is that they do travel pretty fast on a sidewalk or on a parkway, Oak Leaf Trail or one of the other ones, and that kind of scares me. I think they ought to be allowed on the street, at least in the wherever a bicycle is. We have electric bicycles, so I think that saying that an electric scooter is something different is wrong. There's a lot of people renting bicycles, canoes, kayaks. What are all the hoops that people have to jump through to get a permit? I think this is a money grab by the city.
Mark, thanks for your call. Nick Williams?
As far as the hoops of what they have to go through, I think along with this was passed Tuesday, I'm pretty sure the Common Council passed a new ordinance that will allow for a pilot study for dockless bicycle use in the city. So I think they're trying to understand how to incorporate these different modes of transportation in the city. I think that this dockless trend is causing the city to kind of look at how they allow permits for operating these type of vehicles or bikes or whatever. I think that the Boulder Bikes is here, and they have that bike sharing program here, is kind of opened up things. But I think as far as the loopholes people have to go through to get something like this, I wouldn't think it's like a typical operating license that you'd have to go through. I mean, you file your permit, it goes through the certain committees, and then it's passed. And it's a couple of months process, like any typical business.
Well, I want to explore some of those ideas about how this might have gone had the company gone to the city of Milwaukee and said, hey, we want to do this. How can we work together? It seems to me that part of the issue here for this company is the way they operate, and maybe that's on purpose. But we'll get to that and some other questions. We'll take some more of your calls as well. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in just a few moments. Nick Williams is my guest. He's talking about the ordinance or the vote that the Milwaukee Common Council took on Tuesday to allow the city to impound these Bird scooters left out on the street. They stopped short of a total ban, though. Nick Williams is with us, and you can be too at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.